This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. I don't care what you do for a living, Linda Greenlaw works harder than you do. She's a commercial fisherman. For a decade, she captained sword fishing boats, working the waters east of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland from May to October, and fishing in the Caribbean and the Mid-Atlantic in the winter months. It's rare for a woman to work on a fishing boat, and virtually unheard of for a woman to captain one. Despite that, Greenlaw has a reputation as one of the best captains on the East Coast. In her new book, The Hungry Ocean, she tells the story of a month-long fishing trip aboard the Hannah Bowden, a 100-foot steel-hulled boat that Greenlaw skippered for 7 years. On this particular trip, she and her crew worked 10 21-hour days in a row, faced some savage weather, at times encountered too few fish and too many sharks. She also writes about fishing superstitions, what to do with a dead crew member, and near misses with other boats. Since the captain and the crew's paycheck depend on the haul, I asked Linda Greenlaw how much fish she has to catch just to break even.
An average Grand Banks sword fishing trip is 30 days dock to dock, and it's about $40,000 that the owner of the boat would have invested just to get the boat away from the dock. And to pay the expenses, you'd have to catch, you know, generally speaking, at $4 a pound, obviously, you'd have to catch 10,000 pounds to cover the expenses.
Have you ever not caught enough to break even?
Absolutely, I have. And I think the best example of that was a trip I made halibut fishing to the Grand Banks one winter. We hadn't been doing that well sword fishing and thought we'd just nail them halibut fishing. We thought we'd kind of bail ourselves out. My boss had done very well halibut fishing in the past, so I was very anxious to go, anxious to try it, had never done it before. It was probably the worst fishing I can remember in my life. Just, we couldn't catch anything. We fished all the way around the tail of the bank, up around this thing called the Flemish Cap. Went everywhere that we could, covered every inch of bottom that we could legally cover, and just couldn't come up with any fish at any point. I mean, we'd get a little sign here and there, oh, maybe we'll be able to bail ourselves out. This is it. We're on them. And then nothing. Empty hooks, empty hooks, empty hooks. And that trip lingered into 40-odd days. It was a long, disastrous trip. And when we reached shore, a couple of my guys actually kissed the ground when they jumped ashore and never went fishing again.
How do you hold a crew together under circumstances like that?
Well, it's tough during the extreme circumstances like that. I stay very optimistic. Usually the crew will follow the captain's lead. If I, you know, think there's fish around the next corner, then, you know, can usually convince the crew that there's a chance. Unfortunately, in that trip, you know, we just sort of ran out of corners.
You write about something called the fishing mentality. Why don't you tell us what that is?
Okay, when things are going very well, fishermen start getting very suspicious about their good fortune and wonder when the tide is going to turn. Oh, absolutely, there's no way this good fortune can go on forever. So it's just a matter of when. When is our luck going to turn to being very bad? And on the other hand, when things are going very bad, you sort of almost feel like you're due some good luck. And, you know, would you, if we stay out here long enough, things have got to turn around. Our luck just can't stay bad forever.
Where would you put yourself on the fishing mentality scale? Are you on the high end in superstition?
In superstition, I tell you what, I'm kind of weird when it comes to the fishing superstitions. I obviously don't believe that women are bad luck on boats. That's the one that I absolutely won't believe at all, because I've proven that one to be wrong. People are sometimes surprised that I'm still fishing and actually return from every trip. You know, I should definitely have been lost at sea long ago if I'd been bad luck. The other superstitions, though, I'm not like a real believer in them, but they're sort of like the horoscope. You know, if I get up in the morning and I read my horoscope and I like it, I think, cool, today's going to be a great day. And if I read my horoscope and I don't like it, I think, yeah, that's a bunch of bull. Who believes that stuff anyway?
Besides women being bad luck on boats, what are some of the cardinal superstitions in fishing lore?
Number one superstition in fisherman's life is the word pig. You're not allowed to say the word pig on a boat, aboard a boat, anytime, anywhere. The couple different reasons that I've heard for that, and I mean, I grew up with this superstition, so I definitely would never say that, never say it on a boat. A couple different reasons for a pig being bad luck on a boat that I've heard, they seem a little ridiculous, but one is that pigs can't swim and they roll over onto their backs and drown. And the other one is that, oh yeah, pigs do swim, but they do the dog paddle and they cut their own throats with their hooves and bleed to death. So that's the foremost of fishing superstitions. There are others. I mean, you never turn a hatch cover upside down. Bananas are forbidden on a boat. The color blue is an unlucky hull color. There are many, but those are the main ones.
What's with the bananas?
I don't know. I never heard any reason for that, but I definitely don't allow bananas on any boat that I'm aboard.
Also, no whistling, right?
Yeah, no whistling. Whistling is said to whistle up the wind.
Uh-huh. That's a bad thing.
That would be a bad thing, yeah.
How well do you sleep when you're at sea?
Well, I like to think that I sleep well aboard a boat, but it's sort of sleeping with your ears open. You definitely get very accustomed to the sound of a boat and the sound that the engine makes and the sound of the generator running. I know that when I'm sleeping aboard the Hannah Bowden, I can hear when a pump kicks in. You know, it changes the sound of the generator. I can hear the guys opening the engine room door. For instance, if they're taking a watch, they're supposed to be checking the engine room every 30 minutes. And I hear the door opening and closing. I know who's checking the engine room and who is not. I have an ear open for the radio. I like to listen to what's going on, you know, on the VHF or the single sideband radio, as far as traffic in the area, other boats, and maybe other fishermen chit-chatting. I like to keep an ear on that, too.
Sounds like you don't sleep at all.
Well, I know it sounds that way, but maybe it's more or less just resting, because fishing's very physical, and when you do get a chance to lie down, it's just giving your body a rest is just as important as giving your mind a rest.
I imagine, since there's always a man on watch, that it must be your nightmare as captain that he fall asleep. Has that happened to you?
That is the cardinal sin. Uh-huh. Yes, it has. Yes, it has. Bad experience. I was actually in my bunk and had a man on watch. I heard somebody on the VHF radio calling the boat 3 miles from them, and then a little later 2 miles, and then a little later 1 mile. A little later, a half a mile, and I thought, you know, this voice on the radio is starting to sound kind of panicky. So I thought maybe I'd get up and listen to the rest of the conversation and just see, you know, someone's going to be in trouble. Two boats are getting way too close to each other at sea. When I heard the voice on the radio saying a quarter of a mile, I jumped out of my bunk and looked out the wheelhouse windows, and all I could see was white light. The voice on the radio was calling my boat. My man who was on watch was sound asleep, never heard a thing. It looked to me like we were about to have a collision. I turned the helm hard to starboard, and we just missed this other thing. All I could see was lights. We were so close to it. And, of course, I was sort of woken up by this. Just missed, very near miss collision. Got away from it far enough to see on radar that there were actually two targets. It was a tugboat pulling a barge behind it. So we were either going to go between the two, which would have been disastrous, or smash into one or the other, which also would have been disastrous. This man slept through the whole thing, and I was so upset. You know, all I could imagine was, you know, here we are, we're on our way in with a good trip, and we could have all died if I hadn't jumped up. You know, it was a very good chance we all would have been in the water. I actually slapped the guy across the face, and of course he woke up, and, oh, what's going on, kind of thing. And, well, that was the last trip he made with us.
He was fired on the spot.
Yeah, he was, and he didn't even have to ask why.
I'm speaking with Sea Captain Linda Greenlaw. She's worked as a commercial fisherman for two decades, and she's earned the reputation as one of the best swordfish captains on the East Coast. She is, as well, one of the only women to have captained a swordfish boat. Her new book about her experiences at sea is The Hungry Ocean. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is fisherman Linda Greenlaw. She's written about her experiences as the captain of a swordfish boat in her new book, The Hungry Ocean. You tell a story about arriving on ship first on the day you're going to head out on a trip, and you notice a body in the water. Why don't you tell us what that was all about?
Okay, I actually climbed aboard the boat. We were doing some work aboard the boat at the dock. I was the first one there in the morning. Went down and did my engine room chores and decided it was going to be a while before the crew showed up, so maybe I'd go up the street for a cup of coffee. While I was climbing off of the boat, I noticed a body in the water below me, between the boat and the dock. All that was breaking the surface of the water was the crown of this man's head. I figured he was dead. And this was in the middle of the winter, very cold. There's no way this guy should have been alive. I reached over the rail. All I could reach was the top of his head. I pulled his hair and pulled his head out of the water. And I almost died myself because he started talking to me. He was alive. I managed to get him aboard the boat. And he was very intoxicated. About the time that I got him on the boat, I thought he was dead again. He just sort of laid on the deck like a dead fish. And two of my crew members showed up and referred to this guy that I had on the deck as Uncle Patty. So to make a long story short, my first mate had hired this man to go as cook the following trip, unbeknownst to me. So my first introduction to my cook was pulling him out of the icy ocean.
His name was Uncle Patty, right? What happened to him?
Yes. Well, Uncle Patty went fishing with us, and unfortunately, he really must have been a lot deeper into the alcohol than any of us knew. We reached the fishing grounds, and we're just getting ready to set the first hooks, and I sent the cook down below to wake the guys up. You know, hey, we're here finally after 5 or 6 days of steaming. Go get everybody up and, you know, get ready. We're going to set the gear out for the first set. We're halibut fishing. The cook came back into the wheelhouse and said, I think Uncle Patty's dead. And I said, you know, I've heard some pretty good excuses for not wanting to get up in the morning, but really, you know, go get him up. And, you know, he disappeared and came back and said, no, really, Linda, you need to come down and check. I really think he's dead. And I said, oh, my God. All right. Well, I went down, and sure enough, Patty had died in his bunk.
Well, I assume that's the end of that fishing trip. Is that right? What did you do?
That was the end of that fishing trip. I really didn't know what to do at that point. Obviously, I'd never encountered this kind of problem. I've got a corpse on the boat. The first thing I did was I called the Canadian Coast Guard. We were fishing off the coast of Newfoundland. And I told them, you know, I had a man that passed away. And could they come get him? And they said, no, absolutely not. We don't come get dead bodies. So I tried the U.S. Coast Guard and got the same response. You know, we don't come get dead bodies. You'll have to bring them in yourself. So I did. We turned around without putting one hook in the water, turned around and steamed all the way back to Portland. In the meantime, we had to decide what to do with the body, and that was either choices are few. It's either burial at sea, which means throw him overboard, or put him in the bait freezer. His nephew was on the boat. That's why we called him Uncle Patty. And we decided that we would have to go in. We would have to have the body with us, so we would put him in the bait freezer, which we did. It was a long trip home, you know. We encountered a very severe ocean storm on the way home, kind of slowed our progress. It was like 7 days with, you know, Uncle Patty in the freezer. Long trip home.
My guest is Linda Greenlaw. Her new book about her experiences as a fisherman off the Newfoundland coast fishing for swordfish is called The Hungry Ocean. In the fall of 1991, a storm devastated your sister ship called the Andrea Gale. Sebastian Unger told a story of the shipwreck in the Perfect Storm, his novel, and you were also at sea in the storm. You're mentioned in the book. What was your experience during the gale?
People are generally a little disappointed after they read The Perfect Storm and then ask me about my personal experience during that storm. I was 600 miles east of where the Andrea Gale is suspected to have gone down. Of course, we'll never know exactly where because nothing was ever really found. They pretty much disappeared without a trace. Probably two really bad parts of the storm for me were, one, listening to the guys west of me who were struggling with the weather. These are men that I've fished around and talked to on the radio every day for years. They weren't saying, oh, you know, we're scared, but you could tell from their voices and the types of things that they were saying that they were having a very hard time, and a couple of them said that it was the worst weather they'd ever seen, and I know what kind of weather these guys are used to. Knowing that weather moves from west to east, I knew that weather was coming, that bad storm was coming towards me. So what they had, I was going to get. So obviously, I was scared. My crew was very busy preparing the boat for the weather. There's a whole list of things that you do to make a boat as seaworthy as you can make it. Fortunately, by the time the storm reached my position, it had diminished somewhat. We had 70 knots of wind for a couple of days. It was miserable. It was by no means life-threatening for us aboard the Hannah Bowden. Fortunately, we were just in a better place, you know, at the time. The other really bad thing, other than listening to the guys west of me, the other bad part about that whole episode for me was returning to Gloucester. The day that I returned to Gloucester was the day that the Coast Guard canceled the search for the Andrea Gale. So at that point, there was no reason to hope or, you know, wonder wonder if they were going to show up. So that was very, very sad time for me. Usually homecoming is a very joyous occasion. You know, you're glad to be coming in. But during this homecoming, you know, many of the family members and friends of the guys who were lost aboard the Andrea Gale were coming around the dock and asking questions. They understood that I was, the person to have the last conversation with Billy Tyne, the captain of the Andrea Gale. And they wanted to know exactly what he said. And they wanted to know if I knew anything that the Coast Guard had not relayed to them. And I really didn't have any answers for them. It was very sad.
In that last conversation that you had with the captain of that boat, did you get the sense that he knew how bad their situation was?
No, the last conversation I had with Billy Tyne was a very typical conversation. Billy Tyne had been steaming towards Gloucester for 3 days. He was on his way home with a trip of swordfish. And it's very common for the guy to the west to call the other fishermen and let them know what the weather's doing. It's your best predictor of what the weather's going to do, the guy west of you. So he pretty much called me that evening and warned me that his weather had gotten, he had like 50 knots of wind. It had gone from about flat calm to 50 very quickly. And he was warning me, that maybe I would want to consider not fishing that night because the weather is moving towards me. And I had already received some faxes, weather maps, and had decided to not fish. And I appreciated him calling me and giving me that advice and information. That was pretty much the end of the conversation. It was a very typical conversation between fishermen. Conversations always include weather information, and sharing of weather information. So it was not out of the ordinary in any way.
My guest is commercial fisherman Linda Greenlaw. She has a new book about her experiences at sea, fishing for swordfish on other trips. It's called The Hungry Ocean. What kind of trouble did you run into because of your gender on the boat, either as a crew member or as a captain, which I imagine brought different challenges to the job?
Well, to be honest with you, I've been fishing for 18 years, and I've never really thought about being female that much until recently, because obviously I am asked that type of question a lot. So I've had to think about it. And I can honestly say that I can't think of any time that I thought that being female was an obstacle to any success that I've achieved. And by the same token, I really can't use being female as an excuse for any failures that I've accumulated, because I've surely accumulated a few of those also. But gender just hasn't been a factor. The obstacles that challenge fishermen are bad weather, crew problems, and mechanical breakdowns, and they're certainly ignorant of gender. They haven't been any tougher for me than they have been for the men in the same business.
Do you find that you have to go through any kind of hazing procedure with every new crew member? That you have to be tough on them at the beginning so they know they're not just messing around with some woman?
No, I've never felt that way. I think that's due to a couple of different things. One is which I hire my own crew. So any guy who doesn't like the idea of working for a woman definitely is not going to ask me for a job. The other is just the title of captain brings with it, obviously the ultimate authority aboard the boat and some respect. I mean, even the lowliest captains, the dirtbaggy captains that I know, when the crew climbs aboard in the morning, they say, "Hello, captain."
Are there any basic everyday tasks that you find a little difficult or uncomfortable because you're a woman? I'm thinking about going to the head or any kind of issues that involve modesty.
This is the one thing that I did mention in my book. I've always been very careful to go on boats where I have privacy. Even working on deck, I only went as crew member aboard a boat where I would have my own stateroom. I didn't have to share a room with any guys. As captain, I've always had my own stateroom and my own head and my own shower. It's very important because, being the only female on the boat, I have to have some privacy. I will say the one thing, if you're going to push me on this about, there's got to be something about being more difficult for a female, it probably is using the head. In rough weather, it's kind of difficult. You have to brace yourself and try and stay on the head, and sometimes it can be very difficult in bad weather.
Is there a moratorium on sword fishing now? I think environmentalists are concerned that swordfish are overfished. What's your take on that?
No, there's no moratorium. There's a moratorium on permits. So somebody wants to get in the sword fishing business, it's impossible to get a permit to go. But the boats who already have permits are allowed to go. There are all kinds of management plans and regulations in place to ensure that the swordfish stock remain healthy. U.S. fishermen, not just sword fishermen, all U.S. fishermen are among the most regulated fishermen in the world. I would like to add that regulations are a good thing. Fishermen of today are conservationists. I like to know there's going to be a future in fishing. I'm happy to abide by all laws. Sometimes the laws seem a little extreme. And I guess the one gripe that I have is when sort of radical conservationists who maybe don't know that much about the fish stocks, when they come up with a reason to boycott swordfish, such as the Give Swordfish a Break campaign, without knowing all the facts. You know, I find it hard to believe that chefs from restaurants in New York City would know enough about swordfishing to make a really good decision about boycotting it.
Linda Greenlaw, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Linda Greenlaw is now a lobsterman living on Isle of Oat in Maine, where she grew up. Her book is called The Hungry Ocean. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.